This is the 22nd of April, and I'm continuing my interview with John Campbell. John, last time we were talking about parliamentarians that you had some dealings with, and particularly those you admired or respected as individuals and as well as parliamentary operators. And you were about to tell us a story about James Killen.
Yes, I think I said that Killen was one of the better orators in the House. He was a very amusing speaker and did speak very well. Some people said that sometimes there wasn't a lot of substance in some of his speeches, but generally he was one of the better speakers. And I was trying to relate a little story about Killen. And when we were towards the end of our last session, I could not recall the key phrase in the punchline of that story, but I've found the story in one of Killen's little books. So I might just go back to that. It related to his relations with Sir Robert Menzies. And it involved Eddie Ward, who was long-term opponent of Menzies politically. There was a story that during condolence motion on an earlier occasion, Eddie Ward had turned to Arthur Corbell and said words to the effect, "Arthur, when it comes the time for people to talk about me, all I want them to say is he was loved by all." And then when Eddie Ward died, Sir Robert Menzies made a quite generous speech on a condolence motion on the death of Eddie Ward. And afterwards, Jim Killen ran into Sir Robert Menzies in the lobby and said words to the effect, "Prime Minister, how do you manage to make a speech such as the one you've just made about Eddie Ward when you've been political enemies for so many years?" And Menzies, according to Killen, turned his head slightly and said, "Killen, every human being in this world has some redeeming features. I suspect that if we worked at it long enough, we'd find one even in you." obviously that was an instance where Killen was able to tell a story against himself to some extent, and I find that a good little story. I was also talking about some members with whom I had a closer association than I did with members such as Sir Robert Menzies or Jim Killen. One I mentioned was Ian Sinclair, and I think I made a small error in saying that when I had some little social contact outside the parliament with Ian Sinclair's family and him, they were living in the suburb of Deakin. My further recollection is that actually at that stage they were living in the adjacent suburb of Yarralumla, and the family was coming to the church that we attended during that time when they were living there. Another member I didn't mention last time was Manfred Cross. He was the member for the electorate of Brisbane for many years. In fact, his time in the House of Reps coincided almost exactly with my time here in Old Parliament House from the early 1960s until the late 1980s. There was a short a period probably of 3 years when he was out of the parliament, but I had a connection with his family in Brisbane, and he being the member for Brisbane, that was the electorate which covered the area in which I had grown up. Our home was in that electorate of Brisbane, I think, for all of that that period. So, but mainly because of that connection with his family in Brisbane, from time to time we would say hello to each other and have a little conversation, but nothing all that extensive or all that deep. But it was just he would acknowledge that relationship that that I and his family had had in Brisbane. Apart from those I've mentioned, I didn't have close relationships with members. Just to reiterate the point that in the chambers we didn't have a lot to do with the members, but it was when we were away working on committees that we associated much more with them and had more conversation, and perhaps over the meal table or something like that, particularly when we were staying in the same hotels.
Any events that stand out in for you in relation to following up on the same thing, talking, conversations, communication, dealing with parliamentarians on those trips around? Any events that stand out?
No, I don't recall any special occasions. No.
Well, you've spoken about parliamentarians that you respected and you had positive thoughts about. Were there any on the other side of the coin, some that you did not respect as either individuals or as political operators?
I'd prefer not to talk about that side of things. Obviously, the Parliament, being a broad cross-section of the community, there were all sorts of characters. Occasionally, members might not behave themselves as well as they should have, and some of those incidents have been recorded in either the newspapers or books even, but I'd prefer not to go into that side of it.
Did you have to keep information that you got through your work and keep it secret?
Frequently, because in the parliamentary sphere we would often report proceedings of parliamentary committees that were held in camera, and obviously that those proceedings were not public, so we would not divulge any information that we gained in the course of those proceedings. And let me just make the point again that I hope I've made this point before when we're talking about the way Hansard is produced and what gets into Hansard and what doesn't. Many people think that a parliamentary reporter performs the job almost automatically and doesn't really try to understand what is being said and what that reporter is reporting. But to be able to do the job well, and even just to transcribe your shorthand notes, you need to understand as much as you possibly can about the subject to be able to understand the context, because transcribing shorthand can involve making a choice between a couple of alternatives or a number of options. And often the knowing the context and understanding a little of the subject matter will help you to transcribe your shorthand notes correctly. So the context was always significant. Now I've lost track of the actual question you were...
It's related to secret information you were required to keep secret.
That's right, I'm sorry about that. So obviously we tried to understand and remember the things that we were reporting, and if it was a parliamentary committee that was meeting in camera, that was something we had to keep to ourselves and certainly not divulge publicly. And then there were some of the other bodies or organisations whose proceedings we reported, which were completely confidential. And I think I mentioned some of those at previous sessions. Meetings of the Premier's Conference that were held in private, some international conferences that were very much private, and in the case of some of them, highly significant from a national security and defence standpoint. So there were many, many occasions when pieces of information or knowledge about some subject came into our possession, and although I don't recall ever having been sworn to secrecy under the Crimes Act, we always understood that that was our responsibility to maintain the secrecy of those proceedings.
So you think Hindsight staff were not required to sign any, you know, give any formal undertakings in this respect during your time there?
I don't recall having done that myself, or when I was in administrative positions requiring members of the staff to do those things. The only thing in that connection is that for certain jobs we were required to have higher security clearances than the normal ASIO clearance for appointment to the public service or the parliamentary service.
Since you had to keep quite a lot of information secret at times, or keep it under your under wraps, did anybody try to get the information from you, try to let them in on what was going on at any time?
No, I don't recall any instance like that. I would think the only people who might be interested in trying to do that might be press people, journalists, but they understood the procedures and our responsibilities, and I can't recall any occasion when I or any member of staff was approached in that way. Certainly no such approach was ever brought to my attention.
So can you recall whether there were any instances during your time at all when issues about confidentiality came up amongst Hansard staff?
No, I can't recall any such instance.
During your time, you worked in the chambers, there were certainly, the records indicate there were quite a number of disturbing incidents happening, particularly during, I suppose, the 70s. Can you recall any such episodes while you were in the chamber at any time?
Again, I can't recall that I was present when those sorts of things happened, but I have recollections of a couple of them. And as I've said before, my recollection might be reinforced by having read about them rather than by my being present at the time. From the gallery, the one that sticks in my mind and in the minds of a lot of other people was the occasion when the journalist Alan Ramsay called out liar when Sir John Gorton was making a speech. From time to time there were small demonstrations in the galleries, and people were escorted out of the gallery. There was an occasion when the daughter of a member, I forget now whether he was a member at the time or he was a former member at that time, this woman threw an egg or maybe more than one egg from the gallery down onto the floor of the chamber.
What happened then? What? That must have resulted in some disturbed uproar.
A little, but really, the thing that happened was that she was escorted from the gallery. I seem to recall that there were occasions when people tried to tie themselves or chain themselves to the gallery to prevent them being escorted from the gallery, but I don't recall any specific occasion when that happened. Within the chamber, I suppose the most unusual event, and I don't recall now whether I mentioned this in one of the earlier sessions, was when one night, very early in the morning actually, when a member was suspended from the house for persistent interjecting and failing to obey rulings of the chair, got to the point where the speaker told the sergeant at arms to escort the member from the chamber. Almost invariably it didn't get to that situation because any member who was in that situation would realise that he or she should leave the chamber and not put the sergeant at arms in a position where he or she had to physically take the member out of the chamber. But on this occasion, the member decided to stay in his seat, and the other, or some other members of his party, gathered around him so that the sergeant at arms could not get to him. And that situation persisted for a minute or two, I suppose. And my recollection is that the speaker then decided to suspend the sitting until order could be restored, and the member realised that he'd been suspended and it was his duty to leave the chamber and not return to the chamber when the sitting resumed.
Can you recall who the member was?
Yes. In fact, it was Gordon Bryant. And I think I might have, I've been talking to other people in the last few weeks about these sorts of things, and I can't remember whether I mentioned them here or in the other context. I might have mentioned that Gordon Bryant was a member who was a little more difficult than most other members to report because of the speed with which he spoke. But he was a member with passionate views on several key issues, and expressed himself very passionately and vehemently, and sometimes at great speed, which made him a difficult person to report. But on the other hand, he was a very nice fellow, and had a little bit to do with him on committees related to Aboriginal issues, which was one of his one of the issues on which he felt most passionately. My recollection is that it was Gordon Bryant who was involved in that incident.
During the 70s, I understand there were reviews of security procedures which affect both the House, the chambers in particular. Was Hansard at all involved in any of these discussions, as far as you know?
No, not to my knowledge. Security was a matter that came under the jurisdiction of the respective houses, largely, according to my understanding, through the offices of the Sergeant at Arms and the Usher of the Black Rod, respectively. The two houses jealously regarded their rights and responsibilities for the security of their members or senators. And we on Hansard didn't really come into the issue in that way. It must have been round about this time, or perhaps just a little after, that the incident at the Hilton Hotel in Sydney occurred. And up until that time, there were very few security issues here in Parliament House. There weren't any passes or special entry requirements. It was just a matter of coming through any of the doors into the office or into virtually any other part of the building. It was only after the, sometime after the Hilton Hotel bombing, that special security arrangements were made with a pass system and scanners and entry through the lower level of the front entrance rather than up the main steps. But as far as I know, the Hansard staff didn't have any input into the institution of those security measures.
You mentioned the Hilton episode. Of course, some years earlier in 1966, someone took a shot at Harold Holt's office as then Prime Minister one night, an episode which was only really became very public when Wallace Brown issued his memoirs and mentions his then. Were you aware of that at the time, that there had been effectively an attempt on Harold Holt's life?
No, I had never heard anything about that until I read it in Wally Brown's little book. As far as I know, that was never public knowledge and not even known among occupants of the building. The only other major incident in Australia's political life, or sorry, not the only one, but the only one in round about my time, was the attempt on the life of Arthur Corbell in Sydney. Must have been in 1966, I think.
Yes, it was just in just a few weeks before the event happened here in Canberra with Harold Holt. And about July of 1966.
That, of course, happened in Sydney outside the Parliament. But even after that incident, as far as I'm aware, there was no more formal security system instituted here at Parliament House.
So did you after that time have to wear security passes or anything like that to get in and out of the building?
After the Hilton Hotel bombing, we did, yes.
And before then, it was a matter of simply walking in and
yes.
into the offices. Mm.
Yes, we could walk around the corridors and really to any part of the building without hindrance and without any badges or anything apart from the fact that because the number of people working in the building was so small, many of the attendants would know most, if not all, of the occupants of the building. So it was relatively easy to manage the security side of the building.
During your time here, were there any what you might call funny incidents that you remember?
I think I've mentioned the incident occurring, the incident involving Les Halen and Billy Wentworth. That was probably the best example of what you might call practical jokes. I just off the top of my head, I don't recall any really hilarious or okay. One was the night, and again, I don't recall being in the chamber when this happened. The night when somebody, and everybody believes that it was one of the members, fairly late at night, came into the house dressed in a chicken suit. That was quite hilarious. And there was always a little bit of doubt as to who was the member, but I think eventually it was fairly well accepted that it was a certain Tasmanian member who was dressed in the chicken suit.
Who exactly was it?
Well, everybody seems to agree that it was Bruce Goodluck.
Was there any reason why he did this, or was it just to have play a practical joke?
I think so. My recollection is that there'd been a committee meeting which had been going on for well into the evening. I don't recall the subject matter of the committee meeting, whether it had anything to do with primary industry or chickens or eggs or anything like that, but he just somehow or other got access to this chicken suit and decided that he'd cause a little bit of consternation by coming into the chamber dressed in it. Another incident was the occasion, again not in a chamber, but in the members' dining room, when there was a party to celebrate some significant party anniversary, and one of the members, and you keep asking me to name these members, so I'll name this fellow. It was Donald Cameron, who was the member for Moreton for many years. There were several Donald Camerons in the Parliament, and this was the Liberal member for the Southern Brisbane electorate at that stage of Moreton. He had something to do with the organisation of this celebratory dinner in the members' dining room, and he arranged for a large birthday cake to be provided, and in the course of the party, so the story goes, a young lady appeared out of the birthday cake. And he got the credit for that anyway. So that was a funny story from in the members' dining room, not in the chamber. As we go a bit further, I might suddenly think of other incidents, but those are two or three that come to mind.
When you look back on your years in Old Parliament House, what would you regard as your fondest memory of this building?
Well, one of the fondest memories was the incident that I talked about right at the very beginning, when on the Thursday before I actually started work here on the Monday, I was sitting in the little gallery in the back of the House of Reps when Gough Whitlam walked through the door and in effect acknowledged me as the new reporter who had just come from Brisbane. I thought that was pretty special, because later I developed a great respect for Whitlam as a parliamentarian, as a speaker, and his association with Hansard and the use he made of Hansard itself, which I think I've gone into in a little more detail. That's one significant memory. And then, of course, the night we of the last sitting here in Old Parliament House was significant. It had been the home of the Australian Parliament for 61 years. I had been on the Hansard staff here for 28 of those 61 years, almost half. So leaving this building was very significant occasion. From 1972 to 78, we had been in quite reasonable accommodation, especially compared with some other people in the building. So perhaps the move to the new building wasn't quite as significant for us as it was for some other people. But moving out of this building was a cause for some regret. On the other hand, we realised that we were moving into a truly magnificent new building. We weren't successful in getting all the accommodation that we wanted in the new building, but we had been successful in getting one of the prime positions in the building. We had always stressed that because of the system we were using at that time and envisaged using for a reasonable time into the future, it was desirable that our offices be as close as possible to the two chambers. And we finished up being very close to the Senate chamber, and probably as close as it was possible to get us to the House of Reps chamber. Moving into, as I say, into a wonderful new building in which the workmanship was just great. A really, really majestic building was a significant occasion. That we must have done that in the end of June, beginning of July, 1988, after the last sitting here in the Old Parliament House, which was on the sitting day of the 2nd of June, and it spilled over into the under the early morning of the 3rd of June, if I remember correctly.
How did you feel about actually leaving this building itself? What was that?
Well, we were moving into quite good accommodation. Just from a personal point of view, I had a quite good office in this building. In fact, I'll tell you a little story about that before I go on to the rest of this answer. It was the practice in recent years for the both the Senate and the House of Reps to conduct orientation courses for new senators and members. And as the head of the Hansard staff, I was invited to speak to the new senators and members about things to do with Hansard, to explain our system and their entitlements and all sorts of things like that. And on one occasion, which was whenever the election was between 88 and 90, I've forgotten exactly when that election was, but after, sorry, I'm wrong. This occurred when we were still here in the old Parliament House. And I, as I say, I had a quite good office in the southwest wing there where we were. And after, and I, in the course of that orientation program, I had said to the members and senators, my office is open if you wish to come and talk to me at any time about Hansard matters. I'm only too willing for you to do that and to talk to you. And that offer was rarely availed of, but on one occasion it was. And again, I'll mention the name of the member. It was Julian Beale, of course, the son of a very distinguished former member of the House. Julian Beale had been very successful as a businessman and had developed a very successful company and was used to all the benefits and privileges that go with being the head of a very successful company. And he'd been elected to the House of Reps and he'd been allocated an office in the bowels of the earth, which he described as a broom cupboard. And he came up to the office and had a look around and came into my office with his private secretary. And he came over and just had a look out the window and had a little look around the office. And he said, how long do you have to be here before you get an office like this? so that was perhaps an indication of the accommodation that we had and that I in particular had, which was quite comfortable. But by the same token, in the new Parliament House, I had an absolutely magnificent office. As the head of one of the parliamentary departments, it was decided that I was entitled to an office very similar to a member or a senator. So I had beautiful furniture, similar to a member or a senator. I had an ensuite. I had attractive windows with overlooking the one of the courtyards, and it really was absolutely first-class accommodation. I'm not suggesting that all of the staff had accommodation up to that standard by any means, but generally we were pretty well accommodated in the new building. So we were looking forward in many ways to moving up to the new building, and because it was such an important building and obviously built as part of the bicentenary celebrations, we were moving into one of the world's great buildings. So it was a privilege to work there.
So from, am I understand you correctly, there were, you had no real regrets about leaving this building and moving up the hill?
The only regret was the proximity of people in this building compared with the new building, because of the size of the new building and the facilities that were available to the members and senators in particular. There was nowhere near the same level of contact between members and senators, and between members and senators on the one hand and staff on the other. Nowhere near the same level as there had been in this building, where you would often see members and senators and say good day to them, and up in the new building that was quite rare. If you don't mind me just going on about this, because it's in my mind at the moment. Before the new building was chosen, before the plan for the new building was chosen, of course there was the new Parliament House Committee, and at one point the assessors of the design competition had chosen five finalists, and when they got to that point, they very kindly suggested that representatives of the parliamentary departments come and consider these five final designs from the point of view of functionality, how these designs would work in practice. And I was our department's representative in doing that. So we spent some time looking at the five final entries, and I'm pretty sure we were unanimous in choosing the design that ultimately was selected, which, because at that stage that process was being kept under wraps and names of architects were not made public or anything like that, so they were... There were, I suppose you'd call them code words for the various designs, and the successful design, as I recall, went under the code name of Boomerangs. And obviously because of the shape of the large curved walls in that design. And my recollection is that there was unanimity, if not almost, there was almost unanimity, if not unanimity, on the choice of that Boomerang's design, which was the final choice. But I regret to say that that new Parliament House did not work out as well from a functional point of view as people had hoped, largely because of the facilities that were provided for everybody in the building, so that members and senators, for instance, had everything they wanted in their own suites, didn't have to go to the dining room or the bars or other places as often as they used to here in this building, so they didn't see each other as often outside the chambers. And the large distances between one part of the building and another didn't lead to a high degree of functionality. And another example of that is that on the House of Representatives side, there was a non-members bar, And in Old Parliament House, some of the best patrons of the non-members bar were the journalists. And in the new Parliament House, the press gallery rooms are way over on the other side of the building up on the top floor on the Senate side. So it was a real expedition for journalists, for instance, to get from their workrooms over to the non-members bar. And the result was that it didn't get anywhere near as much use as was expected, and eventually it was closed down and has not been used as a bar for most of the 20 years for which that building has been operating. So there were a couple of negative factors in the new building, but overwhelming there were positive factors in working in that building.
Did that, what you describe as lack of functionality, affect the way Hansard worked, or in any way?
Not really, apart from the fact that we had to walk a long way from our offices to the House of Reps chamber, and that really was a waste of time. It didn't affect the operation of Hansard in any material way. We were able to go on in much the same way. Just as an example, the tube system to the government printing office was extended and operated from the foyer of the Hansard quarters in the new Parliament House, as it in much the same way as it always had. So apart from the losing some time in walking between the Hansard offices and the House of Reps chambers, it was, there wasn't a great and of course the fact that attendants, when they were required to deliver documents around the building, spent more time doing that than they had previously in this much smaller building.
At the time when you moved up, did there any other technology that you worked with change at all?
I mentioned that in 1988 we were still unable to computerise the production of the Hansard of the houses. And one area in which we were not successful in relation to the new building was in trying to get the tape transcription centre incorporated in the new building. So the tape transcription centre continued to operate within the government printing office. And its operations had been computerised for several years, so it continued in much the same way. And by and large, the houses, Hansard for the houses, continued much the same way during my time there, because I was there for only just under 2 years.
Taking you back just to Old Parliament House again, you mentioned what you thought, mentioned that your fondest memories. What were your worst memories of working in this building?
The worst memories would have been the unconscionable hours of sitting and the effect that had on family and social life. There were several attempts to make the sitting hours more staff and family friendly, but often exceptions had to be made to changes in the hours of sitting because the government just decided that it wanted to get legislation passed before the end of the sessional period in particular. So it was not unusual for the houses, particularly the reps, to sit until all hours of the morning and sometimes all through the night, or for the Senate to schedule additional sitting days at the end of sessional periods, which sometimes had an effect on people's plans for Christmas in particular, if the sittings extended late into December. And so the staff, particularly the Hansard staff's family arrangements were always likely to be disrupted and without notice. It was not unusual to work very, very late into the night, into the early hours of the morning, sometimes going home the beginning of the next day, just having a little bit of breakfast and a shower and coming back to continue working. That happened every now and again. So the difficulties that the extended hours posed for family and personal arrangements were the main downside of working on Hansard. I think I mentioned earlier that on the other hand there were some compensations in terms of not having to work when most other people were working, so you were able to get things done very easily in terms of shopping and paying bills and those sorts of things when other people weren't doing it, and being able to play sport at times when other people weren't around, and that made it very comfortable to play a game of golf, for instance. So there were those compensations, but the unusual and extended hours were a cause of great irritation personally, and they were one of the main sources of tension and agitation on the part of members of the staff.
Can you recall roughly how long the longest sitting you were involved in lasted?
I don't recall exactly how long the longest one would have lasted, but I had a little note from something I read in one of the books recently that looks like in 1971, for instance, at the end of the autumn, or sometime in the autumn sitting in 1971, between the 4th of May and the 6th of May, there were 50 hours of sitting, and then the Senate sat for 8 additional days after the Senate rose. That's just one example that I picked up in the reading of... And there were examples where a decision was made to suspend the use of reporters in the House and to tape record the remainder of the sitting to allow the reporters to have some break. If the period was extending into a third long day, and that was able to be done after we got quite sophisticated tape recording arrangements, high quality tape recordings, which enabled us to prepare the Hansard in that way from tapes.
Did you prepare them, or did the tape transcription people do it?
No, the tapes would have been transcribed by the people at the tape transcription centre, and then the chamber reporters and supervisors would then have done the editing of those tape transcripts.
How did they manage to keep track of interjections and voices? I mean, voices would be difficult to interpret who exactly was saying what. What sort of backup material or information did you have to help you complete those?
My recollection is that some of the senior officers stayed on and stayed in the chamber and kept what we call a log of who was speaking and the interjectors, and a note of the interjections that would be required to be included in the Hansard. And that was done by several of the senior officers staying on and taking turns of probably half an hour or an hour at a time in the chamber.
So overall, if you think back to the move up, then there was a lot of enthusiasm amongst your colleagues and the staff for moving up, or were there many that was there feeling that perhaps they were leaving something important behind in this building?
I would say that the overall feeling was one of anticipation and excitement in moving into such an important building, but a little bit of regret at moving away from this historic building. But I guess even then we had in the back of our minds the fact that this old Parliament House had always been intended to be only a temporary or provisional building, and that one day the move would be made to the what was always described as the new and permanent Parliament House.
Old Parliament House has a number of photos of you in your office on one of the last days here. Identified as OPH's last moments 364 and 367. When you see this again today, what reflections do you make?
Well, these two photos that I have now, 364 and 367, were taken in the room up in the southwest wing that I've just been referring to, that Julian Beale came to. And looking at these photographs, the things that it brings to mind are our use of the Macquarie Dictionary, for instance. There it is, sitting on in a very prominent position on the desk. When the Macquarie Dictionary was being prepared and was first published, we had quite a bit to do with it. Sorry, perhaps not quite at the time of its publication, but shortly after, because the Macquarie Dictionary